KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Oakland.
I'm from East Oakland.
I live on Belvedere Street, two blocks up from Haight.
I'm from Sunset.
A foggy inner Sunset.
I live in the Mish.
Coming up, we'll hear about how some people in Oakland are trying to start one of the nation's first city-run banks.
When the city gets money from taxes, rather than putting it into a bank, JP Morgan Chase, they would put it into the Oakland Municipal Bank. And then when the city wanted a loan, rather than going to a big bank, they would go to their own city bank to get a loan out.
All about Oakland's municipal bank. Then we visit a city of the dead, just south of San Francisco.
We have 1,600 living citizens, and we have about 1.5 million residents who live underground or in mausoleums.
Crossing the Void, today on Cross Currents. Earlier this year, Oakland City Council voted to stop banking with JP Morgan Chase because of the corporation's investment in causes like the Dakota Access Pipeline and private prisons. The city was trying to line up its money with its values. But then later, the city reversed its decision, maintaining its relationship with the bank for a year while city officials explore other options. One proposal is to have Oakland open its very own bank. The city council is voting next Tuesday, July 18th, on whether or not to study the idea. For locals unhappy with big banks, this would give the city a lot more control over its money. And it would make Oakland one of the first in the country to do so. Our economics reporter Jeremy Dalmas joins me now to talk about the idea. Oakland is considering a municipal bank. What does that mean?
Basically, Oakland is considering opening up its own bank. And rather than doing business with corporate banks, like, for example, right now they do business with JP Morgan Chase, they would open up their own bank and do business with that. So any banking business they would do there. This is not like a bank you would walk down the street and go into. This is a bank that is for businesses and for the city. So you wouldn't be opening up your own personal checking account at a bank like this. Proponents say that the city would charge itself a lower interest rate than a big bank, and so the city would save money on that. And then all that extra money that the bank makes off the city through interest can go back into running the bank, and that can be used to help support local projects, because the bank wouldn't just be doing business with the city. Ideally, it would also be doing business with small businesses in Oakland to help support whatever small businesses that the city wants to support.
Okay, who is proposing this?
Yeah, a couple city council members first proposed this in November, council member Rebecca Kaplan and council member Dan Kalb. And there's actually one industry in Oakland that is excited about this, and that is the cannabis industry.
Aha, why?
People may or may not know, the cannabis industry, for the most part, can't use banks because it's still illegal under federal law, and banks don't want to mess with that. But the city could potentially get involved, and then that would be good for the cannabis industry because it could get services it needs, like taking out loans. And then that would be good for the city because any money that was made on banking through the cannabis industry, like, for example, giving out loans, would go to the city.
So there was a public forum in February. The mayor of Berkeley was there. Does it look like there's some other cities around that might be on board?
Yeah. So there was a forum in Oakland in February.
You were there.
I was there. The room was packed. It was a rainy night, but still, you know, there was like a standing room only out into the hallways. And yeah, the mayor of Berkeley was there. And there is not only talk of Oakland starting its own bank, there's an alternative possible idea to combine Oakland, Berkeley, and Richmond into an East Bay municipal bank. Mm-hmm. And also, San Francisco is considering starting its own bank. The idea has been floating around the city for a few decades. And right now, there's talk of starting a task force in San Francisco to look into a San Francisco municipal bank also.
So is there precedent for these kind of government-owned banks?
Well, there's no cities, but there's actually is some precedent around the country. Puerto Rico has its own bank, but the most famous example is North Dakota has its own state bank that was started in 1919. They give loans out to businesses, to farms, student loans, mortgages, and they help finance the state. And they actually weathered the financial crash pretty well and were able, and I'm talking about the 2008 financial crash, because they were around during the Great Depression also. That's how long they've been around. Mm-hmm. And they were able to start providing loans much more quickly around 2008 compared to other banks. An interesting thing is they're not FDIC insured by the federal government. Instead, they're guaranteed by the state. And so if there's anything goes wrong, state's on the hook. And to get into the how well they have been doing, according to what I found, you know, over the past 20 years, the bank added about $400 million to the state's general fund. So brought in a lot of money. I mean, so that's a big push potentially to get this to work.
Mm-hmm. But then what is the argument against? What do opponents say? And why hasn't this idea spread?
Yeah. So the opponents would say that if anything goes wrong with the bank, then Oakland is on the hook, right? So if the bank fails, then who's going to, you know, pay for that?
The people of Oakland.
The people of Oakland. Exactly. Other people say that the city shouldn't be getting into the banking business. That's for banks. And if you don't trust the city, if you don't trust how the city deals with its finances, that you're definitely not going to trust the city to open up its own bank.
Mm-hmm. What's going to happen now?
Right now, winding its way through city council is a proposal to set aside $100,000 to conduct a feasibility study to look into what it would look like and whether it'd be a good idea or not. And city council is voting on that next Tuesday, July 18th.
Thanks, Jeremy. That's KLW's economics reporter, Jeremy Dalmas. If you've got a topic you'd like him to look into, email him at economy@klw.org. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Cross the Bay Bridge from Oakland, head south on 101 and get on 280. Soon you'll come across a town made up of sprawling tombstones, mausoleums, and monuments. It's a modern necropolis, one where the buried far outnumber the living. But it's also a town as rich in history as it is steeped in death. Our friends at 99% Invisible have more.
All right, Colma.
About 10 miles south of San Francisco, out toward the airport, there's a town called Colma.
I have never been to Colma before, but it's cool. You can take the train right here.
That's producer Avery Truffleman.
Oh, all right. Oh my God, right beyond the train station are already these big, rolling, green hills peppered with tombstones.
73% of the land in Colma is covered with graveyards.
Oh, and they're just rows and rows of big gravestones that look like little houses.
There are 17 full-size cemeteries together in one town. 18, if you include the pet cemetery.
This is huge.
It is a city of the dead, what's known as a necropolis.
We claim to be the only necropolis in the United States anyway, the only city that is primarily dedicated to cemeteries.
This is Maureen O'Connor, president of the Colma Historical Association.
It doesn't mean that there are a lot of cities that don't have cemeteries within their boundaries, but nothing of the concentration that we have here.
And Colma truly looks like a sprawling city, a landscape of mausoleums and monuments and towers and tombstones that glint in the sun for as far as the eye can see. But it is eerily quiet. Here the dead outnumber the living 1,000 to 1.
We have 1,600 living citizens, and we have about 1.5 million residents who live underground or in mausoleums.
Maureen talks about her dead neighbors and her living neighbors with the same vocabulary, like when she referred to John Daly, the long-deceased dairy magnate.
John Daly, for whom Daly City is named, one of our neighbors,
She has a lot of famous neighbors, like Joe DiMaggio and Levi Strauss of Levi Jeans, and Tina Turner's dog is in the pet cemetery. They're all around, and Maureen's house is literally sandwiched between two different cemeteries.
I live across from the Italian cemetery in the front of my house, and then the back of my backyard borders with the Japanese cemetery. And then I have two human neighbors on east and west.
The official town motto of Colma is, "It's great to be alive in Colma."
It's great to be alive in Colma.
Colma had many lives before it became the modern necropolis, before it was even called Colma. In the 1800s, it was rich farmland, since it caught all the moisture off the bay, and most of the vegetables for San Francisco were grown there. At another point, it was known mostly for hog farming, and at another point, it was known for cultivating flowers.
Meanwhile, a few miles north, in San Francisco proper, people were pouring in because of the gold rush. The population was booming, and so was the death rate.
Well, certainly there was an enormous amount of death at that time. I mean, just because there were no antibiotics, people died of stuff that you wouldn't even think of dying of now.
San Francisco's cemeteries started to fill up. And starting in 1887, religious groups and organizations began, one by one, to buy plots of land south of the city to create new burial grounds, which eventually covered over 2 square miles.
In 1924, the cemeteries got together and they decided to incorporate.
Those 2.2 square miles officially became a town, a cemetery town called Lawndale, which in 1941 would be renamed Colma.
And all of this was happening in the context of a much bigger change in American burial practices. For a long time, the dead used to be buried in little squares or churchyards on dusty plots in the middle of town. Graves were all around. It was no big deal.
Municipal burying grounds were right downtown, and they were relatively small, crowded places with really nothing much by way of landscape design. They were just, you know, the land surrounding a church.
This is Keith Eggener, professor of architectural history at the University of Oregon. And in his book, Cemeteries, he talks about how these tiny, plain graveyards were hubs of activity.
You might find plumber or a bricklayer or a carpenter, you know, seated at a cemetery waiting for someone to come along and employ them. Farmers would graze their cows in cemeteries because many people believed that the grass grown in churchyards or in burial grounds was richer and made for sweeter milk. Prostitutes even would sometimes be found in burial grounds. So these were, you know, open public spaces in towns and cities, many of which didn't have much by way of alternative open public spaces.
But by the 1820s and 30s, a couple things happened that changed how burials worked. Firstly, there's a series of outbreaks of disease, and cities were hit with waves of typhoid and cholera and yellow fever, and it was just unsanitary to keep the deceased so close to the living.
Also, cities were growing, and downtown real estate was becoming more valuable.
Gradually, in the United States, the lands of the living and the lands of the dead began to separate. Grave sites ended up far away from the city.
This model of a rural burial, separate from the city, took off in America in the 1830s, when Mount Auburn Cemetery opened outside of Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Well, Mount Auburn was what was called, and what is still called, a rural cemetery. What that meant was that it wasn't smack dab in the center of a town.
Also, it was one of the first cemeteries to actually be called a cemetery at all.
Previously, they'd been called, you know, burying grounds or burial grounds or churchyards. Cemetery was a Greek word meaning sleeping chamber.
And just that word, cemetery, is so romantic and euphemistic. Death had once been deeply enmeshed in everyday life. Americans had home funerals in their front parlors and encountered modest tombstones daily in their town squares. Mount Auburn made burial something removed from normal existence. Rural cemeteries were stately. They looked like they were a world apart.
Mount Auburn was, and still is, beautiful, with emerald grassy hills and manicured hedges. There are statues of weeping angels and Egyptian obelisks, all connected with winding walking paths.
So it was a much more artful landscape modeled on the English garden tradition of picturesque landscapes, as opposed to just simply a flat piece of ground with a bunch of stones, you know, lined up within it.
This new style marked the beginning of the rural cemetery movement in America, and it would go on to influence the design of public spaces more broadly, because this was at a time when a lot of cities didn't have public parks or botanical gardens or museums.
These cemeteries then served as the model for some of our nation's first public parks, such as Central Park in New York, which followed that picturesque garden approach that was first seen in our cemeteries. It was later picked up for college campuses, suburban subdivisions, and many other applications.
The cemeteries in Colma were directly inspired by the Mount Auburn model as well. They were places to go to have picnics and amble around and get away from the smog and soot of neighboring San Francisco.
If the city of the living was designed for speed and efficiency in business, the city of the dead was instead understood as a kind of quiet, peaceful Arcadia, a kind of evocation of paradise or heaven on earth where one would take one's eternal reward.
Oh, and about that eternity thing, that's very American.
Americans have a rather distinct practice of holding to burial in perpetuity. You don't find burial in perpetuity in that many other places.
By burial in perpetuity, he means a plot of land that is yours forever and ever until the end of time, which is different than in, say, Argentina or France or Italy or any number of other countries around the world where families of the deceased typically lease a burial plot. It could be for 5 or 10 years to 100 years.
And if the family doesn't maintain that lease, then the remains are dug up or disinterred, and what is left is often burned. The family is, you know, given the ashes, and then the plots are used for new burials.
And this almost never happens in the United States. American cemeteries would rather double up on burials or do above-ground burials than dig up remains. That's just taboo.
And that's why it was so strange in the early 20th century when almost all of San Francisco's dead were dug up and evicted to make room for the living.
Which brings us back to the graveyards of Colma.
What happened in 1900 was that the Board of Supervisors of the County of San Francisco decided that they did not want any expansion of the cemeteries that were already in San Francisco.
That's Maureen O'Connor again of the Colma Historical Society.
So the legislation was that there would be no new burials in San Francisco, and that went into effect in 1901. So no new burials.
And that meant the existing cemeteries didn't have a reliable source of revenue. And so the cemeteries fell into disrepair and became these tiny wastelands for vagabonds and ne'er-do-wells and grave robbers. And also, they were gross.
So in 1914, another ordinance kicked them out.
They passed legislation that said, not only no new burials, but these cemeteries just look awful. They thought they were disease-ridden. So the city said, the bodies have to be disinterred and moved.
From 1937 into the 1940s, most of the bodies from San Francisco were dug up and moved to Colma, roughly 150,000 bodies in total.
To move a body with the headstone cost the family $10. And if there was no money or no next of kin, the bodies were put into mass graves in Colma. But like respectful ones.
Because when you think of mass grave, you often think of mass executions. And it was not that kind of process. It was a much gentler, respectful process.
The deceased in the mass graves were blessed and memorialized and accounted for in records.
And their headstones were reused as building material.
Well, the mass grave headstones ended up along Ocean Beach. You'll see a lot of headstones out there.
No way.
Yes, they were used to keep from erosion.
And if you find yourself in Buena Vista Park in the heart of San Francisco, look at the paved stones lining the trails and the street gutters.
And you'll see that a lot of them are cemetery headstones.
These headstones, sometimes faded fragments of them, sometimes completely intact, are tucked all over the city, hiding in plain sight.
And they are the closest contact most San Franciscans have with cemeteries. There are only two graveyards left in the entire city. Death is a fact of life most urban dwellers don't see and don't think about. Whereas down in Colma, Maureen confronts her mortality every time she looks out her window.
I look out on the cemeteries and I think, you know, these people are resting in peace, and sometimes I feel overwhelmed by all the things that I have to do. But the day that I wake up that I don't have anything to do, I'm probably going to be moving into a cemetery.
Most people aren't sandwiched between two cemeteries, and we don't really think about the question of what will happen to our bodies after we die.
I ask the question, and very often people are like a little taken aback. Either they haven't thought about it, or they, no, I haven't made any plans.
I certainly haven't made plans. And chances are you haven't either. I have no idea what will happen to my body after I die. And that's kind of unusual in the course of history.
It was indeed the case that, yes, people largely knew where they were buried.
Professor Keith Eggener says that prior to the Civil War, Americans assumed they'd end up in their family plots or town churchyards, and that their parents and children would be buried there too.
That is no longer the case. We move, you know, from job to job, from town to town. We frequently encourage our children to, you know, go out and explore the world, and we don't really know where we're going to be ending up.
Which is why today, many people have opted not to be buried at all.
Cremation has become increasingly popular into our own time, and this brought with it a number of new building types, crematoria, but also the public mausoleums, where you have a small box containing an urn with ashes.
But with cremation, you don't need a connection to one place. Ashes don't have to stay displayed in a columbarium or a mausoleum. They can be scattered anywhere you've ever lived or wanted to live. If your family and friends live all over the world, they can each have a part of you. And there are these services that you can order where ashes can be compressed into a diamond and worn around someone's neck or turned into a hand-blown glass paperweight.
So there's a kind of break, I think, ongoing over the course of the last 100 years or more, in which people were perhaps much more rooted to the land, both in life and especially in death, by virtue of burial and knowing where they were going to be buried, than we are now.
San Francisco's 19th century residents could never have guessed that they'd be evicted and relocated miles away from their hometown to a city of the dead, their headstones strewn about the parks and beaches of the city of the living.
That was an excerpt of the podcast 99% Invisible, produced by Avery Truffleman. To hear the rest of the episode or find more just like it, head to 99%invisible.org or subscribe to the podcast through KALW.org. And that's all for today's show. Our team includes China Armstrong, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Marina Poole, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, Corinne Smith, and Andrew Stelzer. Our show is engineered by James Rowland. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley-Ma. Jen Chien is our managing editor. And a big happy birthday to our news director, Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This is local saxophonist Greg Johnson. He'll be performing at the Sound Room in Oakland on Friday. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.